On Sunday, June 14th at 11 p.m., Sugar Ma Bowl presents drummer, composer, and Golden Globe nominee for the film Birdman, Antonio Sanchez. Join us as we discuss his career and his latest release, The Meridian Suite. That's Sunday, June 14th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. WBAI New York 99.5 FM. Sugar My Bowl is the name of this program. Tonight's guest is drummer and composer Antonio Sanchez. Antonio Sanchez's latest release is The Meridian Suite. So we're going to start off the program with a cut from that release, Grids and Patterns. Sugar My Bowl would also like to send its condolences to Bernardo Coleman and the Coleman family on the transition of Ornette Coleman. What a mark he's left. He'll never be forgotten, especially on Sugar My Bowl. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. WBAI.org on the web. Sugar My Bowl coming up now.
What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I want some sugar in my bowl. I want some sugar in my bowl.
Hi, my name's Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with...
Antonio Sanchez.
Antonio Sanchez, thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl.
My pleasure to be with you.
And I'd like to thank your fiancé, Tana Alexa, whom we'll be talking about later, for getting us together.
Yeah, she was the culprit in this occasion.
Yeah, she grabbed your cell phone and made us connect. So, do you have downtime right now for a change?
Not really. I mean, it's never really downtime, I think, in the musician's life, because you're either touring, and when you're not touring, you're practicing, or you're writing, or you're arranging, or you're rehearsing. So, in our particular situation, there's no downtime, because even though I'm in town, we're rehearsing for the CD release party that I'm having for my band at Subculture on the 19th of June, and then we're trying to buy a house and get married and everything at the same time. It's a little overwhelming. It's all good things.
Well, we can talk about the event that I wasn't aware of, the 19th at Subculture, CD release.
Yeah.
Is that for Migration?
Exactly. That's the official CD release party of the Meridian Suite.
So tell me about this release. How did it come about? I actually had read a little bit about it. Tell me about the suite itself.
Well, this is by far the most ambitious project I've ever done. In some interviews I've done, and actually in the liner notes of the record, I wrote something that, you know, I think is pretty accurate, where as a composer, I feel like every record I've done, I've been writing short stories, right? Because you do a record and you have 7, 8, 9 tunes, and each tune is between 5 minutes and 10 minutes, or, you know, 12 minutes, something like that. So I feel like I've been writing short stories all my life, and I wanted to feel what it would feel like to write a novel. So what I did is I started writing, and I didn't stop. And I just wanted to see where that would take me, where that narrative would take me, and what would happen if I just didn't censor myself in time and style and instrumentation. So I was able to develop a story over a long period of time, like if I was developing my characters in a way. Mm. So it was very, very interesting, very, very fulfilling. You know, when you listen to it, you're supposed to listen to it from beginning to end. It's 56 minutes long. Yeah, I think it's a tour de force, but it has a lot of subtleties. So it has very heavy sounding drums, and then it has another section where it's like super beautiful and delicate jazz waltz, and then on another section you have iwi, and it's all fusion with electric guitar, and in another part you have like a completely naked saxophone cadenza, you know. So it's very interesting what happened when I was just set myself to keep writing and not think about time constraints. And that's basically the product of that mindset.
I read that it actually does relate to the meridian points in your body. Is that true?
Yes. Yes. So the analogy that I wanted to make between the meridians and the composition was the meridians are all this imaginary line that intertwine, that you can find in the celestial sphere, Earth, our bodies, our minds, chakras, all that new age stuff as well. But geographically speaking, and then how you used to calculate time, and, you know, it's very interesting how all these lines kind of interact and intertwine. And the analogy I wanted to portray was that the motifs, the ideas, the melodies on the record intertwine and meet throughout the tune. So it's not like it starts one way and it ends a completely different way. You will find elements that are exposed in various parts of the suite throughout the whole thing. So you keep revisiting those, but in a different way, with a different tempo, a different harmony, different groove, but they keep coming back. So that's the analogy between the meridians and what the suite does as a compositional work.
So tell me again, it's going to be at Subculture. What night is this again, and what time?
This is the 19th of June, which is Friday, and it's at 8 p.m. at Subculture. This great, great place. You know it.
Yes.
In the village. And I just didn't want to do this in a jazz club. I wanted it to be more like a concert seating situation where people were forced to pay attention and not keep thinking what they're going to eat and ordering their ribs and ordering their drinks, you know. I love jazz clubs, but I have to say that's very distracting as a listener and as a musician. So right. I didn't want any of that for this project.
Well, I know of Subculture because of Tana Alexa's CD release party as well. Mm-hmm. And if any of the Sugar Mabo listeners were listening to Tana Alexa and did actually make it over to Subculture, come back and catch Antonio Sanchez during his CD release party on the 19th.
And she will also be there because they started writing it, and having an amazing singer like her at home mm-hmm. is very, very cool, because whenever I want to hear an idea with voice, I'll just call her and she'll come from the other room and she'll sing whatever I ask her to do because uh-huh. she's a great musician. And, you know, that really informed and influenced a lot of the writing for this piece. So I kept hearing voice all over, and she's all over this record, which is really cool.
Well, this isn't her first time recording with you and on your release. I know you're on her release.
Right. She was on my third record, New Life, but she was just on one tune.
Okay.
Because she's in the Meridian Switches from beginning and until the end.
Yes. And by the way, Tana Alexa's release is called Ode to Heroes, and Antonio Sanchez is on that one.
Oh,
that's a great record. I mean, I'm so proud of Tana for putting that record together, and I helped her produce it, and I played on it, and, mm-hmm. and I think it's a great album.
Yes, so that's definitely something to look forward to. Let's start at the beginning. You were born in Mexico City?
Mexico City, Mexico.
On November 1st.
November 1st, correct.
You're
Day of All the Saints.
And for those who are into astrology, you're a Scorpio.
Scorpio, correct. For better or for worse.
Right. I'm a Scorpio as well, but I was born in October.
Ah, we're very alike, you and me, I'm sure.
I definitely noticed it made sense to me, reading certain things in astrology and reading about Scorpions being intense. And your style of playing is very, your style while you're playing is very intense. So that made so much sense to me.
Yeah, I try to keep the intensity just to the playing and then try to be a little more chill with everything else.
Right.
If I can.
And I also was thinking the fact that you're going to be marrying a singer-songwriter, where the stories that she puts together will be from her personal life. And I noticed during the release party there was one that she dedicated to you, and I think it had something to do with you. And you looked kind of awkward on that kid.
Yeah. Well, luckily, our relationship is very good. So whatever she's been writing has been positive.
Yes, it has. Exactly.
Yeah. Whenever I start hearing lyrics about me being a jerk, then I'll get worried. But so far, so good.
Oh, that's great. So I understand that your grandfather was in soap operas?
He is. He's one of the most famous actors in Mexico. He's 90 years old, and he is doing theater right now. He's doing 6 shows a week.
Oh, my goodness.
And then he's doing television during the day.
Oh, my goodness.
So it's pretty amazing what he does.
Tell me his name.
Ignacio López Tarso. I say he's like the Roy Haynes of acting in Mexico.
Oh, right. Oh, that's
he's
great.
Still doing it.
And your family, although there are no musicians other than you. Am I correct in that?
Yes, I'm the only musician. I mean, music has been all around the
right.
family, but nobody really is a professional musician, not even an amateur musician. Nobody plays anything. So it's interesting.
So what was around musically? What did you grow up with?
Well, I grew up with whatever my mom used to listen to, and it's kind of the same thing she still listens to, which is rock and roll.
Uh-huh.
She's a rocker at heart, so I grew up listening to the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Hendrix, Bob Dylan, Janis Joplin, The Queen, The Who, Led Zeppelin, David Bowie, you know, so not a bad upbringing.
No, and I also sort of stumbled across your attempt at being in a rock band. But you changed your mind.
Yes. Well, I tried, and I tried hard with a bunch of different bands in Mexico. But, you know, I started realizing that to make it in a band, the chemistry of the band has to be something very special, and not only musically, but personally as well. And also the look has to be a certain thing. And, you know, I started getting frustrated with all these caveats that are supposed to happen when you're going to become a rock star. So I started getting fed up with the fakeness of it all sometimes. And also that I was dealing with a lot of musicians that were not professional musicians. They were like, you know, young guys that wanted to play and that wanted to make it, but not necessarily become better musicians. So I started getting frustrated with that, and that made me practice even more. And my thinking was, okay, if I get really good by myself, I'm sure people are going to want to play with me no matter what the situation is. So I just started practicing like a maniac, and then got myself into music school. I studied piano first, classical piano, although I had been playing drums since I was 5.
Mm-hmm.
And then I applied to go to Berklee College of Music, and there I went to study jazz drums. Mm-hmm. So that's where I started getting really serious about jazz, and had lessons with some of the best jazz teachers there. And it was a natural way of doing it, starting from rock and roll, then going to fusion, Latin jazz, and then ending up with straight ahead and more improvised open music.
Nice. Now, you said you started playing at 5. Were you playing kits since 5, or were you playing varying types of drums?
I was playing whatever was around. Mm. I mean, I used to, like every kid, I used to drive my family crazy with the pots and the pans and blah, 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 blah.
Uh-huh.
And back then, there were no kiddie drum sets that you could buy. It was either the real thing or nothing.
Oh.
So I begged and pleaded and begged and cried. And when I was 9, finally they bought me like a professional drum set.
Wow.
And that kid I still have in Mexico. Yeah, I wish those little kids were kids would have existed back then, because I would have been so happy.
So how did you manage messing around with a professional kid? I mean, this big thing and you're this little person.
Yeah, if I see pictures of that, it's really funny because I'm sitting down, but it looks like I'm standing up.
So,
you know, I was not that tall, obviously, back then when I was 9. But I managed somehow, mm-hmm. and I started developing actually a kind of interesting bass drum technique because of that, I guess.
Mm.
And it's the same technique that I use until now.
So when I've heard you, you've done varying types of rhythms and things. Well, I know you practice a lot. I got that. It's pretty clear. You definitely, you know, are very familiar with your instrument. But how do you, are you inspired by different rhythms, or do they just come from you internally and that's it?
You know, a lot of it is subconscious. A lot of it is conscious. Some stuff is stuff that I have definitely studied and practiced. Mm-hmm. And developed, and some of the stuff is just stuff that happens, you know, because when you let yourself think, I mean, there's no time to think.
Mm-hmm.
Things are going way too fast when you're playing music for you to think. So it's a combination of, yes, your mind is definitely at work, but your subconscious and all the stuff you've learned, you've studied, you've practiced, it's also there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the combination of the two sides of the brain that is going to make you play what you play. So, yes, of course, you know, I draw inspiration from everywhere. And a lot of times, even if I don't practice something, if I've been listening to something a lot, then it will come out in my playing, because
uh-huh.
that is the subconscious. And then I will work on something consciously, and then that will, you know, come out in a different way. But I think the life of a musician is, you know, you have to think of yourself as a sponge.
Mm-hmm.
And if you open your ears and you have enough connection with your instrument, then all these influences are going to keep happening and keep evolving. And that's why it's so interesting. You know, if I listen to myself playing 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I mean, it's like I'm a completely different guy, different musician. And that's what's so great about it. You keep reinventing yourself. And also the musicians around you that you play with on a regular basis, they influence you tremendously as well. So the musicians in my band, you know, we play together a lot, and we influence each other a lot and make me change the way I see things musically and what we can do on the bandstand. So it's a great friendship and working relationship.
Who's playing with you presently? Is Donnie McCaslin one of the folks?
Well, Donnie is doing the CD release party.
Okay.
Thankfully, he's available and asked him he can do it. But the steady band has been Seamus Blake on tenor, Jonas Creed on piano and Fender Rhodes, and Matt Brewer on electric and acoustic bass.
Okay.
And then Tana Alexa on vocals. And I had as a guest as well Adam Rogers on guitar.
Okay.
But during this subculture, unfortunately, Seamus had other commitments that he couldn't get out of. But, I mean, having Donnie McCaslin is no second best at all. I've known Donnie for years, and we've played in each other's bands on and off. So I'm very lucky that he was around and that he's going to play, because he's such a bad dude.
Excellent. Recording. You had mentioned earlier that, you know, if you became really proficient at your instrument, that you would become in demand, which you've become. You are in high demand right now. When did that start? Who was the person who said, come, play with me, that opened it up for you?
Well, while I was studying in Boston, so I was at Berkeley first, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was from 93 to 97. And then from 97 to 98, I did a program, like a graduate diploma program at New England Conservatory, which is also in Boston. And I decided to have two private teachers that were not drummers. Instead of keep studying with drummers, I decided to study with a piano player and a saxophone player as private teachers. Because I thought, you know, I've been studying with drummers for so long, and they will give you the perspective of a drummer, but I want the perspective of a sax player or a piano player. What would they want from a drummer? Because those are the guys I'm going to end up playing with, not with other drummers.
Right.
So I started studying with George Garzón and with Danilo Pérez.
Ah.
big fan of both of them. But Danilo was touring a lot with his trio back then, and I knew all of his music, and I, all of a sudden, I had a realization, and I had like an actual evil moment where I'm like, okay, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to learn all his music. We're going to be at the lesson, which is just him and me, and then I'm going to ask him, if, hey, Danilo, how does this one go? I love this tune. How does it go? And then, oh, you know that tune? I'm like, yeah, kind of. You know, and then we start playing it, and he would realize that I really knew it. And then we started bringing bass players into the class so that we could play trio. So he started basically grooming me without even knowing it for a year or so. And then one day it happened that his drummer couldn't do a few gigs, and all of a sudden I was ready to go. So first I subbed for his drummer, and then he started calling me, and we started playing a lot. We were touring constantly all the time. Actually, before I started playing with him, he recommended me to Paquito de Rivera. And we did a tour, a long European tour, which was my first one with the United Nations Orchestra that Dizzy Gillespie used to lead.
Yes.
So I was fresh out of Berkeley, and that was my first working summer, was playing with that band. So it was a blast. I couldn't get enough.
Excellent.
And then when I came back, I enrolled into New Orleans Conservatory, and that's when all this Danilo episode started happening. And from Danilo, then I started playing with David Sanchez, with Miguel Tenon, which also I knew from Berkeley. So I was touring already quite a bit, and then while touring with Danilo Perez, that's when I met Pat Metheny. In 2000, something like that.
Well, you just went exactly where I wanted to go.
Yeah, it's a logical progression of events.
Yeah, I was curious how you wound up with Pat Metheny. But the time that you spent with David Sanchez and Miguel Zenon, what was that like for you as a, I don't know, working musician, growing musician, touring musician?
It was great. It was great because, you know, I was fresh out of college. And I wanted experience, and I wanted to play hard, complex, sophisticated music, but that grooved. And I was very interested in everything that had to do with Latin American rhythms. And these guys were at the forefront of that movement. You know, Danilo, Miguel, and David, they were all combining these amazing Latin rhythms with true jazz. I mean, because these guys are jazz musicians.
Right.
There's a lot of Latin musicians that are Latin musicians and they play a little bit of jazz, but all of these guys, they're true jazz musicians and they're bilingual completely.
you're listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM. Sugar My Bowl is the name of this program. What you're listening to right now is It Will Be Better Once People Get Here. It's Antonio Sanchez live in New York at Jazz Standard, a 2010 Cam Jazz Records release. That's Antonio Sanchez on drums, Scott Coley on bass, Miguel Zenon on alto saxophone, David Sanchez on tenor saxophone. Before that, we heard Suite for the Americas, Part 2, from Danilo Perez's Motherland, a 2000 Verve Records release. Danilo Perez on piano and Fender Rhodes, Carlos Enriquez on acoustic bass, Antonio Sanchez on drums, Regina Carter on violin, Luciana Souza on vocals, Chris Potter on soprano sax, and Luisito Quintero on congas. And before that, we heard Ode to Heroes, Tana Alexa's debut release. That's the title track, 2014 Jazz Village Harmonia Mundi release. And Antonio Sanchez is the drummer and producer of this release. Before that, we heard Grids and Patterns from Antonio Sanchez's latest release, The Meridian Suite, Cam Jazz 2015. That's Antonio Sanchez on drums, keyboards, vocals, Seamus Blake on tenor saxophone and Iwi, Electric Wind Interface, John Escrete on piano and Fender Rhodes, Matt Brewer on acoustic and electric bass, and Tana Alexa on vocals. And the CD release party will be June 19th at Subculture. More will be shared about that during the bandstand segment. We open the show with our theme, Nina Simone, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl. That's from the very best of Nina Simone, Sugar in My Bowl, 1967-1972, RCA BMG, originally recorded in 1967. This is the 1998 RCA BMG compilation. Stay tuned for On the Bandstand with our associate producer, Hank Williams, on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web, Sugar in My Bowl, with Antonio Sanchez. Stay tuned.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for June 14th. This show segment features aerial listings of Sugar and My Bowl guests so you can experience them live. This week's show features drummer Antonio Sanchez. You can hear him and the Migration Band at a release party for their Meridian Suite CD at Subculture on June 19th. And we have more music for you this week. David Murray, Terry Lynn Carrington, and Jerry Allen are at the Blue Note from the 15th to the 17th. Bassist Mimi Jones is at the Blue Note on the 16th for the Jazz Journalists Association's annual awards celebration, honoring pianist Randy Weston this year. And that event is open to the public. Bassist Alex Blake is at Kitano with Lynette Washington and Dennis Ball's Jazz New York on the 19th. Pianist Randy Weston's African Rhythms Trio with bassist Alex Blake is at Minton's on the 20th and 21st. Saxophonist Oliver Lake leads his organ quartet at the Blue Note on the 22nd. And pianist Harold Mayburn sits in with saxophonist George Coleman at Smoke from the 19th to the 21st. And he also leads a trio at the Village Vanguard from the 23rd to the 28th. Percussionist Adam Rudolph is at the Stone on the 24th with guitarist James Blood Ulmer. Pianist Mark Carey's Focus Trio is at Minton's on the 26th to the 27th, and he's also at the Harlem Arts Festival in Marcus Garvey Park on the 28th. Bassist Alex Blake, drummer percussionist Bobby Sanabria, and vocalist Tana Alexa are all at the Tribeca Performing Arts Center, Made for New York Jazz Gala, and that's at the Borough of Manhattan Community College campus on the 27th. Poet Abiodun Oyewole is at the Stone with the Last Poets on the 27th, and saxophonist Gary Bartz, bassist Christian McBride, will be in Saratoga Springs on the 27th for the Freehoffers Jazz Festival. Finally, saxophonist Ravi Coltrane is at Birdland from June 30th to July 4th. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, full listings are on our blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog. And that's sugar, S-U-G-A, with no R, inmybowl.org. Playlists and audio from this and previous shows are on the website as well. And if you like what we do, please help WBAI stay on the air by pledging whatever you can, and consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. See the details on our website. This is Hank Williams signing off with our bi-weekly schedule. We're off the air next week, but we'll have updated event listings online and be back on WBAI on Sunday the 28th. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on the Bandstand.
Listening to WBAI 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio and online at WBAI.org.
The role of media in a democratic society should be to empower people to make decisions.
WBAI, speaking truth to power for over 50 years.
You have very few powerful media outlets that are actually doing the two things that I think are the most central aims of good journalism, which is to give voice to the voiceless and hold those in power accountable.
WBAI, your community alternative.
So I wanted to be bilingual as well. And I started playing with them and learning a lot and traveling the world. And in the meantime, playing very complex music that made me grow exponentially as a player, as a musician, opened my ears a lot and learned a lot about band leading, about how to rehearse a band, how to put repertoire together, about composition, just by listening to the amazing tunes these guys would write. So it was a great, great apprenticeship situation for me. And I think that's what's so hard nowadays for kids. There's not that many gigs where you can be active year-round, playing all the time with musicians that are better than you. So they have to become band leaders when they're in their late teens.
That doesn't seem like a bonus, actually, because I've heard some musicians rushing to become band leaders, and it would be nice if they could apprentice.
I know. I mean, it would be nice, and ideally, that's the way you would do it, but unfortunately, there's just not that many gigs where you could do that. You know, so I think some musicians are forced into being band leaders and create work for themselves, because otherwise, nobody's going to give it to them.
Got it. Wow. So working with sax players and pianists, did that help you also to temper yourself when playing with singers?
Well, in the beginning, I have to admit, I was not a very sensitive player. I had a lot of technique. I had a lot of fire.
Uh-huh.
But sometimes I made the mistake of overplaying, not really playing for the music. Because, you know, when you're young, you have a lot to prove.
Right.
At least you feel you have a lot to prove.
Right.
Little by little, after getting my butt kicked by all those great musicians constantly, then I think I started developing this sensitivity towards music in general. So it doesn't matter if I'm playing with a tuba player or a mandolin player or a singer, the music is what will tell you and will guide you in how to play that. So I think once you acquire that ear that makes you play in a musical way, then that applies to everything you do.
You mentioned while playing with Danilo, you were introduced to working with Pat Metheny. How did the call happen? What was your call? See, I'll start a new thing. You know, people ask, what was the call when you worked with Miles? I'm going to start this. What was the call when you worked with Pat?
Yeah, in our situation, it was not a call. It was an email.
Okay.
So sorry to disappoint you all, but it was an email, unfortunately. But it was a great email. What happened is that we were playing a double bill concert at the Torino Jazz Festival in Italy. That was in 99, actually. And Pat played first with his trio, and then Danilo and his trio, we played second. And back then, we were playing a lot of material that was very influenced by, you know, Panamanian music, Afro-Cuban music, mm-hmm. Clave. But it was also very open, very jazzy. It was a lot of fun. It was great repertoire. And I used to play with, like, you know, three or four different cowbells. I had a foot-activated cowbell on my left foot. I had a set of congas, a set of bongos.
Oh, my goodness.
A timbal. It was like a hybrid kit.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, you know. And I was like an octopus trying to play all these things at the same time.
Uh-huh.
And there's a really funny story that after Pat played, because he played first, mm-hmm. and then he stayed backstage while we were playing. He was eating and he was listening to a concert. And the promoter asked him if he liked this band. And he said, oh, yeah, I really especially dig the way the percussion player and the drummer are playing together. The promoter said, no, but it's just one guy. You didn't see that? And then he came on stage and he saw me doing all that stuff. And I think like the wheel started turning right there. And then we met after the concert. Of course, I was just thrilled that he liked it and that he was so cool. And then the same tour, we met in London. I was playing with Danilo and Pat was playing with his trio somewhere else. And then after their show, they came to our show and they saw the last set. And then we exchanged emails and in a couple of days, I had this really long email where he said everything that he liked about the concert, about the gig, everything that he liked about my playing, mm-hmm. but stuff that he was curious about, like would I consider myself a jazz musician or a Latin musician or a musician that can play everything? Do I like going on tour a lot? Have I ever been on really intense tours? What's my health like, you know, on tour? I mean, it was almost like a job questionnaire.
I'm sorry, what's your health like?
Yeah, because the road is really tough. So if you're a frail person, that can influence your road life in a big way.
Ah, okay.
But luckily, I was as strong as a horse, at least back then. And then at the end of the email, he said, by the way, what are you doing Thursday? Do you want to play? And I was like, oh, my God, this is unbelievable. And he had a studio in Times Square back then. And I just went with my sticks, and he was right there, and we hung out, and we played duo for like 4.5 hours.
Wow.
And it was just amazing, you know. And right off the bat, I think our time feel and the way we feel rhythm, it was so obvious that it was just so similar. And so we played like a blues, and we played All the Things You Are, and, you know, all the repertoire that he likes to play when it comes to jazz standards. And then he would say, okay, what would you play here? And then I would tell that he was playing a tune from the Pat Metheny group, like one of the old ones.
Uh-huh.
And I've heard a lot of that material, so then I would try to play as much as I could from what he would recognize as a rhythm for that specific tune. And then he'd be like, wow, that's really good, but how about if you did like 10% less on your left hand and maybe 20% more on your right cymbal, and then 15% less on your bass drum and 5.2% more on your hi-hat.
Oh, my goodness. You know,
yeah. I was like, oh, my God, he's really serious. He's very serious about this. And luckily, I've done my homework, so I was able to do pretty much everything he wanted me to do.
Wow.
And then he said, look, I got to be honest. I've been looking to make a change in my band for a while, and I think you could be the guy. And I'm not saying anything officially right now because there's a lot of loose ends that I got to tie up, but you'll be hearing from me.
Mm.
But we would get together every now and then and jam same way, or I would bring a bass player and we would play together. And this went on for maybe half a year. that we'd be getting together constantly whenever he was in town, whenever I was in town. And then, I was going crazy because I kept hoping that he would finally offer me the job, and it wasn't happening. And then after the New Year's, because this was like in September, maybe, of 2000. And then New Year's happened, and then he said, oh, do you want to get together to play again? I'm like, yeah, sure. And he said, can you come like half an hour before? I got a bass player coming too, so that we can play. But can you come like half an hour before? Because I need to talk to you. And I was like, oh my God, this is either yes or no. And I was freaking out. I was so nervous. And then he said, look, if you want the gig, it's yours.
Oh, so, wonderful.
Yeah, so that was the beginning of an amazing... It's been almost 15 years, so
wow.
It's been great.
The recording, was it...
Speaking of Now.
Yes.
That was the first one.
And then I noticed you did you did a lot, but two that stand out for me is Day Trip with Christian McBride.
Yeah, that was a blast.
Yeah. And the one that you did, Quartet Live, Gary Burton, Pat Metheny, Steve Swallow, and Jewel.
Yeah, when I see the cover of that record and I see my name listed with those guys, I'm like, wow, that's bizarre.
And you know, I thought that had to be like the wildest feeling when I saw the cover myself, you know, because I'm not on this, but I see, you know, there's Gary Burton, Pat Metheny, Steve Swallow, and Antonio Sanchez. Wow.
Yeah, yeah, it's like, you know, the guy in the picture that he looked like he doesn't belong there, like, who's that guy? Yeah. But I'm so flattered that they took me in, you know. It's amazing. I mean, because to be honest, that was one of the stigmas that I wanted to break as a Latino and as a drummer. Okay, you know, I'm a Latino, but I don't only play Latin jazz.
Right.
You know, I want to be taken seriously by the heavy, heavy jazz guys.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked my butt off for that, and thankfully, you know, it looks like it's paid off, because obviously I love Latin music and I have nothing against it, but mm-hmm. I really just want to play music with no rules.
Right.
You know, if it has a Latin influence, great. If mm-hmm. it doesn't, great. You know, I don't want to be confined to anything.
Right.
And these guys, you know, Pat, Gary Burton, Chick Corea, mm-hmm. Charlie Hayden, Michael Brecker, all mm-hmm. these amazing musicians that I've been able to play with, that's how they see music. It's like no rules, you know, that's
right.
It's just music, and it's interesting, and it's challenging, and it's also accessible.
Right.
That's another thing that I really took with me as a learning experience, and I try to apply it to my music all the time. You can make sophisticated music, smart music, complex music, but you can make it accessible. You know, don't leave your audience behind, because I think a lot of the lack of success in jazz right now, and why people think it's a weird, dying art form, is because a lot of times the musicians don't care about the audience. They mm-hmm. just stand on the stage and they play whatever they're going to play. They don't even talk to the audience sometimes, mm-hmm. or they don't know how to talk to the audience.
Right.
They don't know what they're going to play. Sometimes they think they know the first tune they're going to play, and then, okay, let's call tunes, you know, and then there's like a minute of silence in between a tune and another tune, just because they're trying to figure out what to play, and they're, you know, going through the music, trying to find the right tune. Hmm. You know, I mean, imagine if that happened on a rock concert.
Oh, no. Some people would
that
start
would
saying something. No.
Exactly.
Good
so
point.
why can we be a little bit more professional in mm-hmm. that way, and mm-hmm. and give the audience more of an event? You know, I want my show to be an event. That's just a gig. You know,
right.
not just, it's a difference, I think, between a gig and an event and a concert. Even if you're playing a tiny place, you can play it and make it feel as an event.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it has to do with the size of the venue or the size of the audience or the size of the PA. You know, it has to do with your preparation, your intention, and your professionalism on
right.
stage.
Wonderful.
And I've learned so much from all these guys on how to put great shows together. Pat is a master at that. You know, we play shows that are 3 hours sometimes.
Right.
And, you know, he thinks about the set constantly and how to piece it together so that it will be easy for the audience to be able to sit through that.
Mm.
Because we have to be honest, that the audiences are, and not only the audiences, people in general are way more ADD than they were 10 years ago.
Well, that's true.
And it's undeniable what social media and cell phones and cable TV have done. So as a reaction to that, we have to work extra hard to bring the audience into what we're doing, not to leave them behind, not to bore them to death with incredibly long solos that are not going anywhere.
Right.
And that's when the audience starts flipping through Facebook to see who posted what.
Wow. Good point.
That's what I think. I can't generalize because there are great musicians out there that are doing amazing things and doing it right.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm talking for the vast majority of contemporary sounding jazz that it lacks melody and lacks groove and it just sounds, you know, sometimes I go to these gigs and I get bored.
Wow.
And I'm a musician that knows a lot about music.
Sure.
So sometimes I'm like, if I get bored and I can understand what's going on just because it's so complex, what are regular people listening to? I wish I could listen with virgin ears, you know, to music like that, because I would love to know what that sounds like to somebody that has an untrained ear.
I think that the people who probably are not going to be listening to that are not there because they didn't go to the show. It's like, I'm not going to sit through this.
Yeah, but that's a mistake, see, because jazz was pop music.
Yes, exactly. It was dance music.
You know, it was dance music, and you can have a dance element to your music, even if it's, you know, you can tap your foot, you can hum the melody, and I think especially melodic material is lacking a lot in modern jazz. These very complex lines that you cannot sing, the guy can play them because, you know, he thought them out on the guitar or on the saxophone. But they're not singable, and they're not memorable. So one rule that I have as a composer, if I can't sing it, it's not a melody.
Well, I noticed that it's
so
really
complex. I'm sorry. If it's complex that I can't sing it, then I don't think I want it in my music.
Well, I noticed that melody seems to be very important in your compositions.
Yeah, that's what people take away, that and that groove. So if you don't have one, you should have that one, but hopefully you have both.
Right.
You know, in different ways, in different shapes, in different forms, but yeah, melody is paramount for a composition, at least in my case.
Are you feeling more confident these days as a composer?
Oh, yeah. I think since New Life, I really started feeling more and more confident with what I was doing. Mm-hmm. And the suite is, I think, the epitome of my confidence as a writer. You know, I'm really putting myself out there. And the very interesting thing that happened from this project is that because of this long way of writing, I was able to put in a lot of influences that probably would have never come out if I would have each section as a separate entity, you know, different tunes. But because it's one continuous narrative, I allowed, you know, my fusion, really heavy fusion influences to come into play this time, for example.
Wow.
And I'm using like a double bass drum with really, really big drum sound. And it doesn't sound like a jazz kit at all. But it's something that was part of me, and it's part of me still now. And it was a big part of my life for a while. So I said, you know, I'm just going to do it and not think of it as a jazz record, but just as a music record and see where that goes. And yeah, I think my confidence has grown exponentially thanks to just doing it and doing it and doing it.
Well, I'm going to bring it up. It's that time.
Well, before you bring that up, let's just regress a little bit.
Okay.
Let's just talk a little bit about my other album that came out like a couple of months ago.
Three times three?
Three times three.
I was going to bring that up too, but yes, let's talk about three times three.
Yeah, because once we move on to the other thing, then it's going to be hard to come back to that.
Okay, so three times three, how did you put that together? First, tell everybody what it is. Tell everyone what the concept was behind that.
Well, the concept was three times three, three trios, three tunes each. And I wanted to basically do something with the most important trio that I have been a part of in my life, you know, which is the piano trio, guitar trio, and saxophone trio. Those are my three favorite trios and are also the configurations that I played the most in as a drummer. So I wanted to kind of pay tribute to those settings. And I thought, okay, who do I want to call? You know, this is a perfect chance to play with some of the musicians that I've never been able to play with or that I've played with very little, but I would like to play with more. And also this is the perfect chance for me to write something specially for this musician that I want to call. So I started going through my Rolodex of musicians, and I thought Brad Meldow would be amazing. You know, we're basically the same generation. Mm. He's a master. I've been a fan of his for a long time. And I thought it would be amazing if I could write something specially for Brad. So I wrote two tunes and then rearranged Nardis. For him, you know, he's just such a force of nature, you know.
You title it Nardis, not Nardis.
Yeah, I title it Nardis. Yeah, Nardis. Yeah, because it's, you know, the way we played it is very, I think, strong and assertive. Mm. So it was a blast to do that trio. It was with Brad and Matt Burke, who's also on my other two records, The Meridian Suite and New Life. Mm-hmm. He's one of my favorite bass players, and he's in my band. The second trio was the guitar trio with John Scofield and Kristen McBride. Mm-hmm. And John has been one of my heroes since I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. Listened to a band that he had with Dennis Chambers, Gary Granger, and Jim Beard.
Wow.
The album he had was Loud Jazz. It was one of my favorite records, and I used to listen to that album so much. And then, of course, I followed his career throughout many, many changes. So he was like a person that I said, man, if I could have something on tape with him, that would be amazing.
Right.
So I called him, and he agreed to do it. And Kristen, of course, I have been playing with for many, many years with Pat Metheny and the trio. So he was a no-brainer. He was very happy to do it. And I wrote two tunes specially for them. One is a very kind of funky but open tune called Nooks and Crannies, and the other one is called Rooney and Vinsky, because those are our nicknames with Christian and myself that we call each other. Thank you. not going to tell you why. It's rated.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
Yeah. And then I arranged the Fall from Wayne Shorter. And that session was such a joy as well, because, you know, we only had three tunes to do, so we were very relaxed in the studio and, you know, taking our time with the music, and it was just a blast. And then the third trio was with John Patitucci and Joe Lovano, which with John I played many, many times in many different contexts, with Chick Corea, with Michael Brecker, in his own band. We've done a bunch of different records together, and he's always been one of my favorite ones, also since I was a teenager. To have him one of my records was always a dream of mine. And then Lovano, one of the guys with the biggest tenor sounds on the planet, and his approach is just so free and so musical and beautiful, that I said, you know, this trio could be something really fun as well. So I wrote two tunes for them as well, and did this crazy arrangement of I Mean You from Thelonious Monk. And on the record, actually, when we finished that take, which was the only take we did of that tune, you can hear Lovano and Patitucci's laughter because it was just so much fun and so quirky. It was just so spur of the moment, you know, so organic.
Oh, great.
Yeah, so that came out a couple of months ago, I believe. Okay. And it's been a really amazing thing to be able to write for this amazing guys.
And it, too, is on the Cam Jazz label.
Distributed by Sunnyside Records in the States.
How is it with this label, with this distribution? This isn't the only one that is on
there. Yeah, this is my fifth with them. And I really like the way they work. They do me whatever I want to do. Complete artistic creation and creativity. I don't know. I just really like the way these guys work. They're in it for the right reasons. And also, you know, they have nice, decent budgets to record. A lot of companies that maybe have bigger names, they'll give you one day or 2 days at the most to record, one day to mix, one day to master. You know, with these guys, I can get 3 days to record, 3 days to mix. You know, it's like a luxury nowadays to do those kinds of productions. So I honestly think that that's why the records we do sound really good, because we have a lot more time to work on them and to make them sound beautiful.
Are they in Europe?
Yeah, in Italy. Okay. They're Italian company.
So are we ready to talk about Birdman?
Let's do it.
Yeah, people are actually calling you Birdman these days, apparently.
Oh, I hope that doesn't stick.
Well, okay, first off, I understood you... See, I wanted to get this right. When I saw Babel, I was thinking, I will never have to say this man's name, but I love the movie. But Alejandro González Iñárritu.
Yeah, actually, very good, but the accent is on the A, Iñárritu.
Iñárritu. See, I asked the co-worker, but it's like, help me.
I'm impressed.
So how did you wind up working? I understood he heard about your grandfather, and that was one of the things that helped you.
No. I mean, he knew of my grandfather, but I don't think he knew that I was related to him.
Okay.
No, what happened is we have an actual very interesting backstory, because when I was a teenager, there were no CDs yet, and I used to listen to the radio a lot in my car all the time. So he was a DJ.
He had a radio show.
He had a radio show, and a very hip one, actually.
Wow.
You know, so they played some of the coolest music that you could listen to on the radio back then.
Oh, wow.
So they had a nightly show where they play a little bit more sophisticated music. And one night I'm listening to the show, and comes this tune that is really cool, and it has voice, but it has no lyrics, but it's got this electric guitar that sounds like a sitar. You know, it was like a very unique sound. I was like, wow, what is this? And I waited until the end of the tune, and they said, well, this was Last Train Home by the Pat Metheny Group.
Oh.
Wow. The Pat Metheny Group, that's cool. You know, so then I tried to get some Pat Metheny Group records, and fast forward, and I'm playing with the Pat Metheny Group at the Universal Amphitheater in Los Angeles in 2005. And after the show, I'm trying to go to my dressing room, but there's this after party, and I'm going through the after party to get to my dressing room. And this guy stops me, and he's like, oh, man, I just want to say, you know, it's great. You know, I'm such a big fan of this band. You know, I've been a fan for a long time. And now that you are playing, man, it's like I like it even more. And you're also from Mexico. I'm also from Mexico, you know. And he was super nice.
Wow.
And but I was trying to go to my dressing room because I was drenched in sweat. You know, we just played a three-hour, 15-minute set.
Wow.
And I was like, okay, well, thank you. And I was trying to be polite. And then finally I said, well, you know, thank you, but what do you do? Do you live here in L.A.? Oh, yeah, I live here, you know, between here and Mexico, and I direct films. But, you know, he said it in a very, you know, casual way.
Right.
And I thought, you know, in L.A., probably every other guy is a film director, so I wasn't particularly impressed. But then I asked him, well, anything I would have seen? And he said, well, you know, I did this thing, Amores Perros, and 21 Grams. And I'm like, oh, my God, that's you. And, you know, I freaked out, and he was really happy, of course, that I recognized him. And then we totally hit it off from moment on. And every time I would go to L.A., I would give him a call, and he would come to my shows. And whenever he had the premiere of Babel and Beautiful here in New York, he called me, and he invited me, and it was just great.
Wow.
And so that's how we met. In 2013, January of 2013, out of the blue, I'm in Miami with Tana and her grandmother. We're coming out of a classical music concert. We just saw Joshua Bell coming out, and I'm driving the car, and my phone rings, and I see on the caller ID, it's Alejandro. I'm like, wow, that's strange. And I picked up, and I'm like, hey, Alejandro, what's up, man? And he said, Antonio, you know, I'm working on my next film, and it's a dark comedy, and I think it would be great if the whole score was just drums. What do you think? You want to do it? Are you in? And I'm driving, you know, I'm like, what? Sure, yes, come in. Okay, great. So I'll send you the script, and we'll talk later. And he hung up, and I hung up, and I told Tana, I'm like, did that just happen? That's crazy. I mean, it's crazy that he would call me to do his film score, and then it's crazy that he just wants drums.
Right.
So in the beginning, I was so excited, and then I was petrified. I was like, oh, my God, how am I going to do this, you know, because there were no points of reference for me to check out. Like, oh, yeah, I'm going to look at all these movies that also have drum scores, you know, to see how this could be done. But at the same time, it was refreshing to start with a completely blank slate. So he sent me the script, I read through it, and honestly, after reading it, I was even more confused. Because it reads in a very weird way. It's not like a book. You know?
Right.
There's a lot of subtext that is missing from the script.
Right.
So I couldn't make heads or tails from the book. And then I talked to him and I sent him some demos. But my demos were very structured. And after I sent him the first demos, he said, you know, they're really cool, but they're basically the opposite of what I'm looking for. I'm looking for something really organic and improvised and jazzy. And he kept using these words. And I was like, you know, that's great because I'm a jazz musician. So that's going to work just fine. So once he said that, I relaxed and we did some demos in New York while they started shooting the film. So the first demos I did, there was no movie to look at because it was being shot at the same moment. And we did like 60 or 70 demos of different scenes. He would just explain the scene to me in great detail, and then we would imagine the scene together. And every time something new happened in the scene, he would raise his hand to signal that the next phase of the scene was happening. So it was completely by instinct that I was guiding myself.
Wow.
And yeah, it was very cool because it was very freeing, very liberating. I could just do whatever I wanted. And then they spliced those demos and they took them to the set and they actually shot and rehearsed with those demos just to see if the rhythm would work of certain scenes. And then they took those demos and they superimposed them on the rough cut of the film. And they brought me to LA. They showed me what they did. And I went back into the studio and we did everything basically, but now looking at the film and taking great care in detail, you know, dialogue and movements and cues and all these things that Alejandro wanted me to catch, or places where he wanted me to stop playing because somebody was saying something important and then start right after. I would like to say it was very challenging, but it wasn't. It was just so easy and so fun. It was really, really cool. It was very relaxed. And, you know, I think you can tell by the way I'm playing in the movie that I'm just being myself. I'm not trying to do anything that I'm not, which that's what's so great about it for me. You know?
Excellent. The thing that I think that's so amazing about it is how it hit cues. I mean, it was like an extra character, your music.
Yeah, and also it's so quirky and so original that I think it really stuck in people's minds. You know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it actually translated the character you're playing. It was like, oh, my God, that is that character. That's how he is.
Yeah, I mean, we were really trying to portray the inner turmoil of Regan Thompson, the main character played by the amazing Michael Keaton.
Yeah.
And I think the drums were the perfect vehicle for that because he's going through a lot of stuff. And I think with a regular movie scores can be very manipulative. So there's a sad scene and then you hear all these sad chords, and then there's a happy scene and then it's all major chords, you know? Basically they tell you how you're supposed to be feeling, you know, they direct you towards a certain atmosphere that you're supposed to be hearing and feeling. But the drums is a lot more abstract, so then it was more up to you, you know, what you wanted to feel. But it was very impactful as well. But there's other parts that are very evocative and just ruminating about different possibilities with the drum. It was just a lot of fun to do.
Unfortunately, the Oscars decided that what the hell was that? I'm sorry. It's like it didn't qualify.
Well, yeah, they eliminated it from contention, basically. And originally they said that, well, by the way, the day it got eliminated was the day the score got nominated for a Golden Globe.
Wow.
So that was really interesting. And then they said that the official reason was because there seemed to be more licensed music, which was there's some classical music in the film as well.
Right.
More licensed music than original score, which was not true. So then we did a recount, we appealed, we sent the information, we all wrote letters, and then they came back because we were sure they were going to reverse it because it was technicality.
Right.
And then they came back and they said, well, actually, the original music is too diluted by the licensed music.
Oh, my goodness.
So then, you know, at first it was one thing, and then when we rectified it, then they decided it was a different thing.
Wow.
So, you know, the whole thing was really suspect. Everybody was outraged.
Yes.
And I think public opinion was completely on our side.
Right.
They were like, you know, these people have the chance to at least, if they're not going to nominate it, at least let it compete. You know,
right.
Why are you eliminating something that is so unique, so new, so daring?
Right.
You should be rewarding it. You know?
Exactly.
And what I always said is what pissed me off was not that it was not nominated. What pissed me off was that it was eliminated.
Right.
You know, so if it's not eliminated, then people can vote for it or not.
Right.
But that's where public opinion should have the power, not these guys that decide what is eligible and what isn't. Because it was eligible for every other award show,
right,
and it won a bunch in the process. So the Oscars are the only ones that were right, and everybody else was wrong. You know, it just seemed to me that they were intentionally trying to get rid of the score because, A, it was just drums, and it's probably something that they don't consider worthy of a film score. B, I'm not a professional film scorer. I'm just a jazz drummer, and they're like, who the hell is this guy? To be competing with all this, you know, classical and orchestral composers.
Right.
And, you know, it was all me. I didn't do anything else but play drums by myself.
Right.
I didn't employ this humongous orchestra that went through the union, you know.
Right, right.
So I think everything seemed to point out to the fact that they just did not want me in their garden playing.
Just foul.
Well, what I always say to myself, and I always say to everybody, that the real prize for me is just to be a part of that movie. I mean, to have been able to do what I do in that movie, in that context, and then it going all the way to winning the Oscar, you know, that's mind-boggling.
Yeah.
And my name will forever be attached to a piece of pop culture.
That's right.
You know, just, you know, it can be a bad thing to be attached to a project like that.
Right.
And it seemed like they tried to get rid out of me by eliminating me, but then goes all the way to win the Oscar. So even by trying, they just couldn't. You know, the drums are all over that movie.
That's right.
And, you know, it's just... And also the controversy of being eliminated, I think, gave me so much press that it was almost better. It was hard to watch the Oscars, but I had to because the movie was nominated for so many things. And I literally jumped out of my seat and cried when the movie won. I mean, it was... I've never been so emotional, at least not in a long time.
It's an amazing project, and I'm glad that Mr. Iñárritu,
Iñárritu,
chose you to be the, what can I say? It's like the magician behind the drums.
Well, yeah, I'm just so proud of what they did and what we did together. Every time I see that movie. And actually now this will be aired after, but I'm going to play Bonnaroo. Bonnaroo, it's this humongous pop festival. It's like hundreds of thousands of people in Tennessee.
Oh.
And they have a film series, so I'm going to go into Birdman. They project the film.
Oh my gosh.
They play live.
Oh wow. You're going to have to do this in New York. You know that, right?
You know, I did that already.
No, you didn't. When?
I did it a couple, maybe a month and a half ago.
Something. Stop like it. That. That's just wrong. And you didn't create a Facebook event or anything?
It got sold out.
Of course. Well, you got to do it again.
We will. We're just trying to get a licensing agreement in place with Fox. It has been very hard, but hopefully we'll get it done soon.
Okay. Well, Antonio Sanchez, let's remind the people of the Subculture event. It was June 19th.
19th at 8 p.m. And Subculture, yeah, very close to where everything is happening. So it's an amazing venue. Very cool.
It is very cool. Very nice sound and everything. It's a nice vibe. And to have Antonio Sanchez and Migration doing their thing, along with the vocalist, Hannah Alexa, it's going to be a beautiful thing. And I'm looking forward to I will be there. I will make a point of being there.
You better be there. That was the only reason why I did this interview.
Wow.
So that you would come to my gig.
All right. Now I have to be there. All right.
There you have it.
Well, Antonio Sanchez, thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl. I really appreciate the time you've given us.
My pleasure, Joyce. Thank you.
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. You've been listening to a discussion with me, Joyce Jones, and Antonio Sanchez. What we're listening to right now is from his latest release, The Meridian Suite, Channels of Energy. And don't forget, the CD release party is at Subculture on June 19th. And you can find out more at sugarinmybowl.org, sugainmybowl.org. And before that, we heard Internal War Antonio Sanchez from Birdman, or The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance. That's a 2014 Milan Records release. Before that, we heard Rooney and Vinsky, the nicknames for Antonio Sanchez and Christian McBride, from 3x3. That's a 2015 Cam Jazz Records release. Antonio Sanchez on drums, John Schofield on guitar, and Christian McBride on bass. Before that, we heard Arena Sand, Antonio Sanchez from his release Migration. That's a 2007 Cam Jazz Records release. Antonio Sanchez on drums, Chris Potter on tenor and soprano sax, David Sanchez on tenor sax, Scott Coley on bass, and Pat Metheny, special guest, on guitar. Stay tuned. Coming up next is La Nueva Alternativa, right after Sugar Mambo. We will be back on the 28th of June with a special focusing on the 20 years of New Vision Jazz Festival. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. Stay tuned.
Hello, bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.